I think that's good enough. You got most people is good enough. So today's talk, I did say I was going to talk about some more insight, some deeper insight practices. And the first thing, when I mentioned that to Venerable Chagga, he said, "Oh, you're going to talk about Vipassana this morning?" Not really. Because just to get this out of the way, sometimes people have the idea you got to do calm samatha first and then inside afterwards, or just do inside or just do calm, as if these are two totally separate things. And Ajahn Chah, when he was ever asked that question, he'd answer in the same way. He just put up his hand and he said, "Now you can see the front of my hand, but the back is there. Now you can see the back and you can't see the front, but the front hasn't disappeared." He said, "That's just like Vipassana and Samatha." Yeah, you may think you're just doing Samatha, you can just see the front of the hand, but Vipassana is right behind. You think you're just doing Vipassana, but Samatha is right behind, because you cannot separate the front and the back of a hand. You can't separate Samatha and Vipassana. When you are calm, then you see things as they truly are. I gave that simile on the first night. When the lake is perfectly still, when there's no wind, and there's no ducks on that lake, that then you get a perfect reflection of the moon and stars in the sky above at night. But when there's ripples or waves on the surface of the lake, the image you see is distorted. In the same way, when the mind is still, only then do you get a perfect reflection of the way things truly are. If there's any thoughts, any waves, any disturbance at all in the mind, it distorts the truth. Which is why the Buddha said again and again that samadhi, stillness, is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. When you're still, you see the truth, the Dhamma. And of course, I would say there's many, many things you'll understand on this retreat, not just always the deep things, but some of the ordinary things which help your life along. On this retreat here, you do notice as you get more still, you see more beauty, you feel better, the health gets better. That's just the nature of not meditation, but stillness, calmness, not doing so much. And it's also to put more happiness and joy into what you're doing, which is why we have the teddy bears. And because when I came in here, I saw a couple of people doing backwards walking meditation, and they're just putting a bit of fun and games into the walking meditation, which is great, because sometimes you get a little bit bored. Walking, sitting, and if your meditation is not really hot and you're not very peaceful and beautiful, sometimes it gets a bit boring. Oh, what should I do? I can't sit because I fall asleep. I start thinking. I can't walk because I get bored. I've had too much tea. I go back to my room and go to sleep, and I can't go to sleep. What should I do? And so the following method, if that the person I'm describing is you, the following method will work 100% guaranteed. It's a different method of walking meditation. And before I describe exactly what it is, I would point out to you that in the history of Buddhism over 2,500, 2,600 years, when it's gone to different countries, it's always adapted to the local culture. And it's always incorporated some of that culture into its traditional practices. And now we're living in the age where Buddhism has come to Australia. And so we've been developing an Australian flavour for Buddhism, putting some of the culture of this great land into Buddhist practices such as walking meditation. And this particular practice is called kangaroo walking meditation. So you start at the end of the walking path. And one of the monks demonstrated before. Can one of the nuns demonstrate this, please? No, don't point at that. Uh-oh, they're pointing at you, Venerable Karunika. So please, stand up. Come on, stand up. She's now going to demonstrate kangaroo walking meditation. Now you start, come to the front here. You've got to get the knife, they get the food. They don't wait for a moment. So first of all, your posture. Sometimes people ask, what do you do with your hands? In kangaroo walking meditation, that's right, like this. And in usual walking meditation, it's left and right, left and right. That's not what kangaroos do. So kangaroos hop. So, hop. And again. That's right, until you get to the end of the path. Then you turn around and hop back in. Thank you so much, Reda Kumika. That's called kangaroo walking meditation. Now, you think that's stupid, that's a joke, but try it. Just do it just one circuit, I mean just from the beginning to the end, turn around and come back again. That will just take away all of your depression, all of your misery, all of your boredom. It's fun to do, and if there's anyone else in the room who sees you, it brings them so much happiness as well. It really is compassionate, yeah? Not outside of bread. No. As long as you don't eat the grass, you can do it inside. And make sure someone sees you, though. Because it's just a waste of time doing it by yourself. Because that creates a lot of happiness for others as well. So I challenge every one of you to give that a try. Unless you've got, you know, a bad leg or no leg or bad knees or something. Then you're exempted. Everybody else, give it a try at least once. That gives you a bit of energy, a bit of fun, a bit of happiness. And you find by insight that if you put some fun, joy and happiness into the meditation, it gets so much deeper. It's a free energy. When you feel joy and happiness, the mind is very easy, or easier, to concentrate, and not to concentrate, to make still, to get to peacefulness. That's one of the reasons why that when you don't put happiness into whatever you're doing, you find it's just a struggle. Watching your breath. So it's because of that, you know, we're doing kangaroo walking meditation. We also can do a different form of breath meditation. Because I've invented all sorts of different types of meditation. Because, to show you what I mean now, a little exercise. When I say go, not now, when I say go, I want you to close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, and then open your eyes. Clear instructions? Okay, go. Should be very easy. Just 3 breaths in and out. Now, I can guarantee that when you did your 3 breaths, you started with an in-breath and then an out-breath. In-breath, out-breath, in-breath, out-breath. And the 3rd out-breath, you open your eyes. Now, I want you to do it the other way around. When I say go, not now, when I say go, I want you to breathe out and in 3 times. Start with the out-breath and then in-breath. Out, in, 3 times. And on the 3rd in-breath, open your eyes. Go. And you will find, to your surprise, that it's totally different. If you breathe out first and then in, it feels very different than breathing in first and then out. So you've got another way of meditating to make it more interesting for you. So if you're bored and you're not getting anywhere with watching the breath, we do what I call backwards breath meditation. You breathe out first and then in and see what happens. It just makes it a tiny little bit more interesting. Because you find that sometimes we become creatures of habit. When you're creatures of habit, always do the same thing in the same way, which, you know, is a bit of a danger when you go on a retreat like this after the 6th or 7th day. You get into a routine and a habit, which means you get dull. You're not alive anymore. Which is one of the reasons why it's good to change that habit. Do things a little bit differently. Even simple things. If you want to get mindfulness first thing in the morning and wake up with a bit of more energy, when you brush your teeth, what part of the mouth do you start brushing first? Are you one who starts on the top or the bottom first of all? On the side or on the middle first of all? Find out, and tomorrow do it differently. If you always start on the, like I usually start, on the top row of teeth on the left, just to be rebellious, I do it on the right, down the bottom, first of all. As David Bowie used to say, live on the wild side. But doing a simple thing like that, doing it differently, means you have to be more mindful. You're not a creature of habit. You do things a little bit differently, and you get much more insight into new ways of looking at life. Because this is one of the trouble with all things. We do things always the same way, and we get dull. We do things a bit differently, and then you wake up. So even just the way you're sitting meditation, try a little bit different every now and again. Put your hands in a different place, or even just turn around and meditate facing another direction. Do things slightly differently just to wake yourselves up. And just a tiny different posture makes a huge amount of difference to you. So those are just a little bit of ordinary insights which actually help the meditation along. And we also get the deeper insights, because yesterday I was talking about all these people arguing about what's right, what's wrong, about the nature of life, the nature of God, the nature of Nibbana, dependent origination, all these really, really high ideas, which people often they just do through thinking. And instead of doing it through thinking, which never really gets you very far, we want to use insight to discover the truth. Because otherwise you'll just be arguing all the time. And in order to arrive at that insight, we do need to have this practice of calming the mind, letting things be, being still. So all of the external stuff can fall away. So we're not concerned with our past and our future, which sometimes wastes so much time. We're not too concerned with our body, which also takes such a lot of your time during the day. And instead we can actually just put all of our attention, at least as much as we possibly can find, just being able to observe this thing we call the mind. And if we can spend time observing the mind without being distracted by other things, it's like the Buddha said, a person, a chemist who wants to understand the nature of gold, has to get pure gold, first of all. If there's any impurities in that gold, any other elements or minerals in that gold, you can't really find out what its real qualities are. So the first job of the chemist is to purify the sample, so it's 100% pure gold, no other trace elements in it, and then you can do your experiments, you can discover the nature of gold. And that was the simile of the Buddha, to be able to find out the nature of this mind. The one who is listening to me right now, the one who does all this stuff, the one who feels fear, pride, and all the other sufferings of interesting things of life. Now, who is this inside of you? Or what is it inside? And that's what we call the mind. And first of all, you know, in our modern world, we're supposed to, in the Western world, this is just a little comment, in the Western world, many people don't even acknowledge the existence of a mind. Keeping on assuming that the mind is just some byproduct of the brain. And when the brain goes, so does everything. So in other words, when you die, that's it, finished, poof, gone, totally. And they always say they got their culture in the West from Greece. But the Greek philosophers, people like Aristotle and Plato, wrote about reincarnation. And an interesting thing about Plato's Republic, where he wrote about reincarnation, this is just a side bit. He says that when a person dies, they get carried over the river Styx to the Elysian fields, where they rest. And there, having rested for a while, this is Plato's description of the reincarnation process. And after they've relaxed in these Elysian fields for a while, nice and comfortable, then they can select their next birth. And he said, stupid people, really idiots, They choose to be famous, rich, and powerful. The people who are wise have been there and done that. They're the ones who choose to be ordinary people. Because it is an idiot who always wants to be rich or famous. Now, I'm not rich, thank goodness, but I have, you know, got a claim to some fame, which is one of the reasons why I can't go to the toilet whenever I want. I have to run the gauntlet of people wanting photographs and signing books before I get to the toilet, like I said in Hong Kong. Or a similar thing even happened in Changi Airport some years ago. So similar. I was coming back from the United States. It's a long plane ride. Just transiting in Singapore, but I had a lot of disciples who worked for Singapore Airlines, so they met me at the gate inside the terminal. They were going to give me lunch. So they gave me a nice lunch, but I didn't really enjoy it because they were talking to me all the time, asking me all sorts of questions on the Dhamma and Buddhism. And you just had a long journey, you know, over the Pacific. And I was really tired, but you can't tell people just to get out and leave me alone. That's not very polite. And being English, I have to be polite. It's in my genes. So I couldn't tell them to go and get lost. So I thought, how can I get a bit of peace and quiet? The toilet. And again, I went into the toilet. If you've been to Changi Airport, it's these big rooms with lots of cubicles. And honestly, as soon as I got into the toilet cubicle, the toilet attendant, there's always a toilet attendant there, he recognized me. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I ask you some questions about Dhamma? Even the toilet attendant bothers you. They're just supposed to be there to clean the toilets, to make them available for you, but not this guy. He was questioning me all the time. Still, I couldn't escape. So that's why you just have to let go sometimes. But nice thing about it, he said, that's very nice, I want to make a donation, but being a monk, I can't carry any money. So I said, I can send it if you like. And we didn't have anything to write it on except literally a piece of toilet paper. And I wrote the address of Bodhinyana Monastery on the toilet paper, and 2 weeks later we got a donation from him. And that really moved me. Because these are guys cleaning the toilets, that's, you know, not exactly a well-paid job. He was so impressed, and he went to the trouble of keeping that piece of toilet paper and sending a donation to the monastery. That was really, really nice. But anyway, that was just saying, you don't want to be famous. You don't want to be rich. I went to this rich person's home in Perth once to bless it on the river. Huge mansion. And she was the one, really true story. Some of them I make up, or sometimes I exaggerate, but this is not exaggerated. As soon as I arrived in her mansion, then I needed to go to the toilet, and I asked which way to the toilet. And in such a big house, it was so complicated, she did get a piece of paper and write out a map. That's how big the house was. So these days, mansions in Australia, they come with their own GPS. You can find your way around. But for me, after going to the toilet, coming back, you're just talking to the donor, a really rich Thai person. And I asked her, how many people live in this big mansion with you? And that's when she says, only me. I live alone. And when I heard that, wow, this huge place. I don't know how many bathrooms and bedrooms there were, but she lived there totally alone. And I said, well, why don't you get some friends or relations in? She said, I'm scared. Whenever my relations visit, I'm scared they're going to ask me for a loan or ask me for some money. Same as my friends. I can't trust them. And that's why she was living alone. Her wealth was actually driving her away from everybody. And so this poor woman was there in this huge mansion, imprisoned by her wealth. And I thought, my goodness, please never do that. That's why some people sometimes, they know that monks have got powers. I was saying about Ayakema last night, being able to, you know, to pull the lottery thing and getting it exactly right and getting winning the, not the lottery, the those pokey machines. And many people ask me for lottery numbers. so they can win the lottery. And I've actually refused to let them know them. Because I know that if I give you the winning lottery number, say Prashant, if I give you the winning lottery number, then I'll never see you again. You won't come here. You'll be off in your private jet all over the world. So that's a good reason. I'm not going to do that anymore. Not because, you know, I don't care about you. Because I care about you. That's why I won't let you become rich. So, and the wealthy people and the famous people, they were the idiots, the ordinary people. And then according to Plato, they went over the river Lethe, L-E-T-H-E, which was the Greek word for forgetfulness. So they forget everything so they could have their new life. And that was what they had in Greek culture. And also, with that, they also had what they always called the six senses. They always had the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. And the sixth sense was the human mind. Aristotle called that the common sense, because even Aristotle knew that whatever the mind, whatever you hear, see, smell, taste, touch, the mind also knows. So he called it a common sense. And it's very strange, this is Western culture, which says it had its roots in Greece, how somewhere along the line we lost one of our senses. We lost our mind. We abandoned our common sense. That's one of the reasons why Western culture is like it is. Denying the existence of the sixth sense, the mind. So what we do in meditation, we actually find out, you know, number one, if there is a mind, exactly what it is. And you don't do this through philosophy, you do it with direct experience. So when you are meditating here, because you're not seeing anything, or whatever you're seeing is still doesn't change, the sense of sight turns off. After a while you can't hear anything, hearing turns off. First of all, it just feels so distant. Somebody sneezes next to you and feels like 100 miles away. You're losing your sense of hearing. And then, you know, smell, taste, that's very easy to turn off. And then your body disappears. You can't feel your legs. You can't feel your hands. You can't feel your head. You can't even feel your breath anymore. That's a sign that the five senses have stopped. Well, they're still, you know, there, but you're not paying any attention to them. So they have actually disappeared for you. And the only sense you have left is your mind. You're away. You're awake. Very awake. But you can't see, hear, smell, taste anything. And to tell you what this is like, or what it can be like, I love telling the story of this man, Greg. For years I never said his name because I didn't want him to get bothered by people. I haven't seen him for a while now. I think he's dead probably by now, so many years ago. He was a fellow who would come to our center in Perth regularly, do some meditation on a Saturday afternoon, you know, with 45 minutes. Well, that was his maximum. He couldn't sit really longer than that. But one Sunday afternoon, he told his wife, "I'm going into my bedroom to meditate." So off he went. An hour and a half later, he hadn't come out, which was not usual. So his wife went into the bedroom to check on him, how he was. And when she opened the door, there she saw her husband sitting perfectly still, still meditating. Very still. Too still. She couldn't see him breathing. She checked on him, couldn't see any breathing at all, so immediately rang 000, the ambulance. And the ambulance came within 5 minutes with the sirens wailing, na 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 na, and the medics ran into his bedroom and checked his pulse. There was no pulse. So they got out the stretcher, they put him into the stretcher, into the back of the ambulance. His wife was with him, as fast as they could to every red light, really trying to save his life because he wasn't breathing, his heart wasn't moving. They put him straight into the hospital, it was the Charles Gardner Hospital, in the emergency room. They put the ECG down here, sorry. I get too excited sometimes. The ECG on his chest. Flat line, no heart. The EEG on his head, another flat line. He was dead. And he would usually have been taken straight down to the morgue in most cases. And he was very lucky that he wasn't taken down there. Because he came out of meditation afterwards. Imagine, you're under the sheet in the morgue. And you don't know how you got there, you're just in your bedroom meditating. And suddenly you come out of meditation. It's okay for you, but those poor attendants in the morgue. Ah! Maybe under the sheet's dead next. So, there he was on the table, no signs of life at all, except, this is, for those of you who know your sutras, this was a fascinating observation, because the doctor on duty that day noticed his body was warm. That was odd. Normally, when your heart isn't pumping, when there's no brain activity, you go cold, sign of death. But he was still warm. And you go back 2,600 years and go into the sutras, you find, when somebody asks, what's the difference between being dead and being in deep meditation? You know what the Buddha said? In dead, you're cold. Deep meditation, your body's warm. Exactly as the Buddha said. He was warm. It's fascinating. But anyway, because he was warm, that was strange for this doctor. And also because the wife had said he'd been meditating. And the third reason, because the doctor was Indian. Now, he'd grown up in Australia, but his parents had come from India and had heard that in India that some of these yogis can go into such a deep meditation they can suspend all of their senses. And so he thought, maybe that's this guy. So he gave him defibrillators on his body. The electric shock. Bang! Have you seen that on the movies, on the TV? That, no, actually, your body even lifts up a couple of centimeters from the table. Bang! Bang! Many times they tried to get his heart going again. Many times it failed. But he never gave up. He kept on trying and trying and trying. And trying and trying. Nothing worked. Until he opened his eyes. Leant up. He came out of his meditation. What's going on? Where am I? I was in my bedroom. What's happening? And as soon as he opened his eyes, beep, beep, beep on the machines. Perfect heartbeat, perfect brainwaves. And the doctor was stunned. He gave him a thorough checkup. Couldn't find anything wrong with him at all. So just sent him home. And he walked home with his wife. And he said, all the time that was happening, he was blissed out of his head. The best experience that he'd ever had in his whole life. Totally happy. He got into a deep jhana. And He didn't hear the silence. He didn't feel the medics rushing him into hospital in this ambulance at full speed. He never even felt the defibrillators on his body. Didn't feel that at all. That's what we mean by a jhana. So still, you've separated from your body for a while, in beautiful bliss states, and your body is so healthy afterwards. There's no damage at all to it at all. You're so, you haven't breathed for a couple of hours, 3-4 hours, but it doesn't matter, your body's fine. Now that's what a jhana is. So, now you've got rid of those five senses. All that's with you now is that sixth sense. It's proved there's no five senses there, but you're still perfectly awake. In fact, more awake and alert, more mindful than you've ever been ever before in your existence. You're really alive now. And what you have in front of you there is the mind, the citta. So, with more observation of that, like I said, what's this? You keep on looking at it, and the longer you look at it, the more you understand what this mind truly is. And this is where you get the great insights into what is this thing which is looking at me and hearing me right now. What is this thing which makes all the decisions? Who are you? But who are you is not a good question. Who are you assumes you're something, you're just trying to find out what. It's much better to say, what are you? Or, are you? So, now you have data. Many minutes, hours of seeing what this mind is like, but it's not disturbed by these other things. And also, you have a mind which is the desire and ill will is so subdued that after these experiences, you just see what's there, no matter what it is, rather than trying to bend the truth to please your views, to please your understanding. I got this quote from a book the other day, which was a very beautiful quote. It says something like, memory is, is more faithful to your views than to the truth. You remember what you want to have happened, rather than what truly happened. You change the past to suit yourself. That's why you can't trust memory, except when you're not, no desires, no ill will, no wishful thinking, no denial, when you're so peaceful and still, you see what's really happened, rather than changing it to suit yourself. So that's why this practice starts to get you to see what this mind is. So what do you see? First of all, the first simile, because I was talking about Google cars the other day, and Google cars are such a wonderful expression of Dhamma, of the truth. So much so that when one comes out, these driverless cars, I am going to get one for the monastery, not just to show off, because they are a symbol of anatta. And it was my simile years ago which I concocted of the driverless bus. It was a simile to describe life. Life is like a journey. That's, everybody uses that simile. And in this particular simile, it's a journey in a bus. And you're sitting in the back there somewhere, looking out the window at the experience of life. And you notice that sometimes life is beautiful and happy. And you look through the window and it's just such wonderful scenery. Waterfalls, rainforests, parrots, beautiful birds flying around, sunshine, mountains. It's so beautiful. And you want to stop, at least slow down, and really enjoy the beautiful moments of life. And what happens? Your bus accelerates. The bus driver pushes his foot down, and you speed through the beautiful, happy moments of life too fast. The good times don't last as long as they should. And when you get into trouble, when you get sick, disappointments, problems, pain, it's like looking through the window and seeing toxic nuclear waste dumps. And you want to get out of there as soon as you possibly can. In the painful moments of life, you want to escape. And what does your bus driver do? Slows down. Even stops. So the painful disappointments, frustrations of life, they last longer than they should. Why? Because you've got a stupid bus driver. The one driving your life needs to be taught some wisdom so you can have more happiness and less suffering. And many people actually come to places like this. They come to Buddhist temples to learn just that much. So they can train their bus driver, the one in charge of you, to be wiser. So you can let go of the shit of life, like I keep telling you. But when I say those words about taking the dog shit which you tread in and digging it under your mango tree, you will find, yeah, it's okay, but there's still more dog shit out there to tread in. It doesn't get rid of it totally. When I say life can be happy, become a monk or a nun and have a happy life. Is it a happy life? No, there's still a lot of shit in Dhammasara. And in Bodhinyana as well. You still have problems and suffering. And so you find it doesn't matter, even if you're wise. If you're compassionate, you still get shit. So, sometimes you think, this bus driver is so stupid. It always tends to, you know, to get more and more pain and suffering when you shouldn't really have that much. Happiness, you're in this beautiful place. You're in Jhana Grove, there's food, there's a nice place to stay, beautiful scenery, you've got nothing to do, you've got no boss giving you a hard time, you've got no kids running around driving you crazy, You've got no problems at all here. Are you blissed out and happy or still suffering? And sometimes you say, even in China Grove we can suffer. It's not fair. You stupid mind, stupid bus driver. So many people feel that the purpose of spiritual life is to find that bus driver and teach it how to be wise, so it can let go of suffering quickly and have more happiness. So in order to teach that bus driver, that's called self-improvement, self-help, trying to make you, yourself, wiser, more compassionate, so you don't have so much suffering. But my self-help joke, there was a man who went into the bookshop and he was looking for a book on self-help. So he asked the person at the desk, which way to the self-help section in the bookshop? And the person on the desk said, sir, if I told you, it would defeat the purpose. The self-help book. Okay. So anyway, that's what many people are into. But I don't buy into that at all. Because basically, yourself can't be helped. Too far gone. So anyway, the purpose becomes in meditation. Find the bus driver's seat. Who is in charge of all of this? Who is making all these dumb decisions? Stupid decisions. So, you know, your life is just totally out of control. Who's making these decisions? So before you can teach the driver to be wise, you've got to find the bus driver's seat. So in meditation, it's like getting out of your seat and going to the seat of the bus driver, deep inside the mind. Five senses gone, going in, into the deep meditations, into the jhanas, and there you find the bus driver's seat. And it's not what you expect. Meditation eventually becomes not what you expect at all. Weird and strange stuff, way beyond your imaginations and expectations. When you do find that bus driver's seat, you find it's empty. No one's in there. Totally empty. Just like a Google car. Just programmed. Not you. There's no driver. So, when you see that, that shocks you. You always thought that you were in charge. How many of you thought you decided to come on this retreat? I'm sorry, you had no choice. You had to come. But you thought you chose, didn't you? How many thought that what you had for breakfast this morning, you chose what you're going to eat for breakfast? Did you choose? Or was it programmed? It appears like you chose. That is one of the great delusions. Professor Libet, one of these great psychologists, he had this experiment which became world famous. Because, simple experiment, he had his victims, his students, in one hand they could flex, open their fist, flex their fist, close it, open it, whenever they wanted. And the other hand there was on a button. So when they decided to close their fist, press the button. Open it, press the button. Do it as simultaneously as they possibly could. At the same time, they had all these electrodes on their brain to find out when the brain decided to choose. It's something called, what was it called? A something potential, which always precedes a physical act. They wanted to see whether that sort of light in the brain, that electrical movement in the brain, was before that phenomena which we assume to be our will. You know that when you decide to do something, you can actually see yourself deciding to do something. You can be aware of that, you can be mindful of that. And because when we're mindful of that thing we take to be will, the action follows afterwards. We make that connection, we think that thing we think to be the will caused the action. But Libet found out that even before we decide, the brain has already started moving. Brain first, then comes this phenomena which we consider to be the will, and then the action comes afterwards. The will did not originate the action. By the time you were aware of this thing you thought to be choice, the action was already operating. It's a myth. It's an illusion. And if you want to see other experiments on that, just look at hypnosis. Hypnosis is great because it really uncovers stuff which is very spooky. With my friend Bernard, we used to go to all this psychic research lectures in Cambridge. And we used to get some great lecturers there. Every year we'd get a hypnotist in. And every year students would volunteer to be hypnotized. I volunteered once, but I'm not a good hypnotic subject. And there's always one student. This hypnotist could totally hypnotize and get him to do really embarrassing things like take down his trousers. And you're a bunch of 18, 19, 20, 21 year olds. This was hilarious. Laughing our heads off at the stupid things made this poor kid do. But that was just for entertainment. There was also a lot of very important stuff he was teaching us. And one thing which he did, this hypnotist, we were in the audience, we could see everything which was happening. He told this guy that after he comes out of hypnosis, when the lecturer, the hypnotist, touched his right earlobe, this student had to stand up, no matter what was going on, stand up and sing the British National Anthem in a loud voice. And then he took him out of hypnosis. Of course, we all heard that, but he was hypnotized to not remember it, except to follow the instruction. And we were all waiting. I was waiting. When is this hypnotist going to touch his right earlobe? See if it's going to work. And sooner or later, he did. And during the middle of some speech, the hypnotist touched his right earlobe. And this student stood up and sang God Save the Queen from beginning to end in a loud voice. And we were killing ourselves laughing at him. You know, as students would do. If you stood up now to sing the Indian National Anthem, Prashant, in a loud voice, and people would laugh at you. What a stupid thing to do, doing the middle of Ajahn Brahm's talk. What are you doing that for? But he did it right to the end. Withstood all the jives and laughter. And when everyone had quietened down, that's when the hypnotist asked him, why did you do that? And this young student gave a reasonable answer. And that's where I got my goosebumps. It was very clear to me and almost everyone else in that lecture theatre that that student had the experience of him freely choosing to sing. Even his most ridiculous thing to do, even though we knew he'd been programmed into it, he'd been programmed to do it. For him, his perspective was it was no different to everything else he chose to do in life. Just another choice freely made. That is how it appeared to him. It gave me goosebumps because I thought, how many other choices which I make are not mine, are programmed into me? That started me doubting this thing called will. Are you really in charge of you? And when you get to the bus driver's seat simile, you realize none of it. You are totally programmed. That's scary, but it's true. So, how do you know that? When you get into these deep meditations, especially the jhanas, things are missing which have normally been there. This is the meaning of what we call anicca. The simile now comes of the tadpole and the frog. The best simile I've come up with to describe insight and why the jhanas are necessary. Once upon a time, there was a little tadpole who swam in one of the dams at Dharmasara Nuns Monastery. And there was a little tadpole swimming around, and because Dharmasara has now been well established, there was the little school for tadpoles, so they could learn reading and writing. And this little tadpole was very clever, so she went to high school, where she majored in chemistry. And there's even a university in the dam at Dharmasara, where this little tadpole did a PhD on water. I've even heard some of the visiting monks and nuns talking Abhidhamma on the nature of water. What is water according to Abhidhamma? So this little tadpole thought she knew everything about water. Got a PhD in it, knew Abhidhamma about water. But honestly, with all that study, do you think a tadpole can know what water is? A tadpole can't understand water no more than a fish can. Because a fish has been born in water, lived in water all its life, knows nothing but water. So cannot understand it. But the difference between a tadpole and a fish is that one day the little tadpole, she grows arms and legs. She changes into a frog. And the new frog doesn't know really what it's doing. One day jumps out of the lake and is sitting on dry land. And that's the weirdest thing she's ever experienced in her life. Totally different to everything she has ever known. Dry land. And she realizes it's different because something which has always been there is now missing. Something which was taken for granted because it's never changed is missing. Water. Only now can the frog understand what water is. That strange stuff which is now not there. That is the only way a frog can understand water. By jumping out of the lake. In this simile, which I hope many of you got by now, you've heard it before as well, you are jumping out of will. It's always been there for you. You haven't always exercised it, but it's always been there. You can choose whenever you like. Right now, if you want to, you can choose to get out of here. You're not taking the will away, but you don't exercise it. It's always there for you. But when you get into jhanas, it's missing. It's gone. Not there anymore. You can't do anything. Which is one of the reasons why, in those deep meditations, you sit perfectly still. You can't get out. You don't want to get out. You don't not want to get out. Wanting is totally gone. For a short while. And that was one of the reasons why that monk, I told that Vietnamese monk in Sydney, he sat for 8 days. And he apologized afterwards. Sorry, if I had any will, I'd have come out. But the will wasn't there anymore, so couldn't do anything. That's what it's like in the deep jhanas. Will is gone. And that's something you've never experienced before. If you haven't had those jhanas, there's no way that you can understand what the will is. No more than a fish can understand what water is. Which is one of the reasons why people celebrate their will. They don't want to get rid of will and just subdue it and make themselves peaceful. They just want to enhance their will. Give it the power of wisdom. Will with wisdom means no suffering, you think. Try and be smart. Try and be clever. Try and have lots of skillful means. But when you get into these jhanas, you realize it's not going to work. The will itself is the problem. That is something which is quite challenging for people. In fact, scary. One of the scariest things you can ever hear. So scary, I can never forget the time when I started going to Singapore to give lectures. And I would talk about two bad bricks and opening the door of your heart. And good, bad, who knows? People love those stories. But one day, the president of that time, Sun Han, he was a lawyer. He said, "Can't you give a deep talk for a change?" I said, "You want a deep talk?" He said, "Yeah, just for a change." So I gave a deep talk on non-self. And the following morning, he picked me up to take me to another appointment. He said, "Don't ever do that again, please." I was so scared. I never slept all night. Because I trust you. You don't sort of mess around. And when you said there's no will, that scared the life out of me. And there's something which you cannot accept. Anyone who agrees with me now, you're just deceiving yourself. You can only see this once you get in these jhanas, a big kick up the arse. So you see things in a totally different way. Because this will, things which are always there for you, in Pali, we call this Nietzsche, stable, always there, permanent, if you like. We always think, a fish always think that water is permanent. It's always there, it always has been there. You can't even notice it because it's permanent. But things which suddenly vanish when they're not supposed to. Water which has been there ever since it was born, now vanishes. That is anicca. Things which are stable, always been there, we assume they're going to be there forever, disappear. Ooh, that can't be truth. That can't be who I am. You are not the one in charge. I realize I am not the one in charge. Any Dharma, any wisdom you hear here, which is deep and profound, do not blame or praise me. All comes from Ajahn-chā. Any jokes you hear here, don't blame me. That came from my father. He was always telling bad jokes. Because he told bad jokes, he conditioned me. So when I tell a joke, please, I'm totally out of control. It's not my fault. My dad's fault. And that is so true. The way you work, the way you do things, the way you speak, how much of it is really you? How much of it is your conditioning? 100% conditioning. That's scary. But of course, that's what I say. You can't accept that until you get into these jhanas and it blows you away. Number two, which disappears when you're in a jhana, is again your body. Body disappears. That's an easier one for you. The five senses, totally gone. Such a relief not to have a body. And so if you, this body has always been there for you. Yeah, you can go asleep, but it's there for you when you wake up in the morning, and when you're asleep you don't really know what's going on. Sometimes when you have dreams, you're in a body, some sort of dreamlike body. So there's always a body there for you. So you get used to it. We got so used to our body, we don't know how much it hurts. And I'm not talking about those of you who are sick in great pain, got an ache here and a terrible disease there. It's just everybody's body hurts. We got used to it, we don't notice it anymore. But when your body vanishes in these deep jhanas and the body's not there anymore, oh, that's really cool. So peaceful, so nice. One of the things which everybody gets if you get into a jhana a few times is you're never afraid of death anymore. Death sometimes, come on, bring it on. As this, somebody showed me, they always get these jokes off the internet, like, good health is only the slowest way to die. I quite like that. Good health is only the slowest way of dying. So you're going to die anyway, so get it over and done with. That's my message. And anyway, somebody gave me this great definition of life. What is life anyway? Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. I thought, how wonderful that is. That is accurate. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. That's brilliant. It's not what people want to hear, of course, but it's so accurate. So anyway, when you get into a jhana, the body vanishes, five senses go, and you're so blissed out, so happy. What you understand afterwards, why is this the biggest bliss you've ever experienced in your life? Way better than anything else. And the reason is that it means something is missing. Something which has already been there for you, always there for you, the five senses and the body. And afterwards, you're never really too interested in this body and five senses anymore. You're not interested anymore because you realize just how much of a burden it is, how heavy it is. And that's one of the reasons why people who do actually die, have near-death experiences and come back again. That's one thing they always know as well. Death is a release. It's a freedom from the prison of the five senses and a freedom from the body. It's wonderful. So free. But if you don't know that, you're always afraid of death. So please remember this, that this meditation is like learning how to die, only safely, so you can come back again afterwards. and live a life which is not so attached to the body. You can just be at peace with the body but not really attached to it. Can you realize it's just a waste of time? It's just really heavy and burdensome. You're not doing that out of negativity because you know something much, much, much better. The bliss when the body has vanished. Oh, how free that is. So one of the things there is you're never afraid of death anymore. And dying, yes, pain is not very nice, but once you actually get there, yes, at last, now I can be free. So these are the things which you learn. And when it comes to that's actually understanding dukkha, suffering. You know, people say the body's suffering, but they don't understand what they're talking about. But if you've had a jhana, you understand totally what the Buddha was saying. And lastly, so the mind itself, the knower. There's two parts to what people think they are. Sometimes they think they're the body, but that's usually easy to get rid of. Sometimes they think they're the will. That's much more difficult to realize you're not in charge, not in control. The last thing is to realize you're not the one who knows either. This knower, the consciousness, that too vanishes, disappears, fades away. You see it fading away. The reason why there's many different jhanas, because at every jhana, something else vanishes and disappears. As you go into the heart of the lotus, it's an old Tibetan the mantra, the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. You know what Om Mani Padme Hum means? It means praise to the jewel in the heart of the lotus. And what is that jewel in the heart of the lotus? When you open that lotus out, like I was saying in meditation, just through making peace, or rather mindfulness and kindness. Mindfulness and kindness, like the light and the warmth of the sun, opens the lotus. You go deeper and deeper and deeper in. You get these levels called the jhanas. They're really delicious. And you go deeper and deeper in, and deeper in, until you get the last layer of petals in the lotus. And when they open up to see what's left, the jewel in the heart of the lotus, who you really are, you know what you find? There's nothing inside. That is the jewel. Emptiness, anatta, nothing in there. Oh, what bliss. My last little story for the insight talk today. My personal encounter with Ajahn Chah. I was with that great teacher for 9 years. Many times he tried his best to enlighten me. Many times he failed. And one of those times, he would, just before he had his stroke, he would come to this monastery where the Westerners lived to take a sauna. The monks, the Western monks, we read in the ancient days, they had saunas in Buddhist monasteries in India. The saunas were not invented by the Swedes. The Indians got there centuries before. In India they had all these saunas in the monasteries. And it was part of just an ordinary monastery in the time of the Buddha. They had a sauna. So we built a sauna. I don't know why. It's hot enough already in Thailand, but some of these monks. But anyway, it was a good excuse to get Ajahn Chah, when he was becoming sick, to come to our monastery for a weekly sauna. And the only reason we really did it, we really built it, I was involved in building that thing, the only reason we really did this was actually to get into the monastery, because he'd always give a talk before his sauna. So he'd see him every week. And sometimes he'd give really good talks, sometimes really boring talks. Don't ever think that Ajahn Chah was this great speaker. I was there for 9 years, many times bored out of my skull listening to this rubbish, out of great respect for the teacher. But it was worth it, because every now and again he'd really hit the spot, or just say one line which would change your whole life. That was his great skill. But on this day, he gave a terrific talk. And if you get a really good talk, you get so inspired afterwards, you get so much happiness. And I have been in this monastic life long enough to know, once you're inspired, don't throw that away. So usually you go and help him with the sauna, you know, giving his bathing robe, giving the towel and stuff. But this time I said, no, let someone else do that. I went round the back of the hall, sat down, brilliant meditation. Because when you're inspired, you've got this wonderful energy and happiness. That is so easy to get into deep meditation afterwards. So thanks to that brilliant talk, I have a great meditation, really deep. When I came out afterwards, my first thought was to do something for my teacher, to try and help him. So I walked towards the sauna, and I realized I was too late, because I saw him coming in the opposite direction. We were going to cross paths. And what happened next was one of the great experiences of my monastic life. We were going to cross. Ajahn Chah could read your mind. No doubt about that, because he read my mind. And when you've got nice meditation, you can feel him getting inside you. But for once, I did not mind at all. I just had a nice meditation. I was actually quite proud. Come on, have a look. At last, I've got something worth looking at. Come on, have a look. So you can feel him sort of scanning you, getting inside as we pass, or just as we stop as we're about to pass. And then I saw him looking at me. He realized I'd had a very deep meditation. He tried his hardest to enlighten me, to give me that last little piece of the jigsaw puzzle. He looked at me with these incredibly laser eyes. Brahma Wangso. That's the real name, Brahma Wangso. Ajahn Brahma is the shortened form. Brahma Wangso. Why? He said it like that, barking at me, really grabbing my attention with incredible power. Why? And that was the question he was asking, the question why. And I looked at him and I replied, I don't know. I was still really, really stupid. I was honest. You can't lie to your teacher, it's a waste of time, he knows you lie. I don't know. And so he realized I was telling the truth, so he just laughed. You know, whenever you do anything stupid with great teachers, they never ever punish you. They just think this is so hilarious, and they laugh their heads off. My stupidity and the stupidity of so many other Western monks caused so much happiness for our teacher. He laughed so much at the ridiculous things we did. But anyway, then he screwed his face up again. And he said, Brahma Wangso, I will tell you the answer. And when he said that, I was really, really interested. The great Ajahn Chah, just no one else was there, just Ajahn Chah and myself. He was going to give me this incredibly personal teaching. The answer to the question why, from one of the great monks of the last century. The answer to the question why, I couldn't wait to hear this. Yes. And he said, are you excited? That's what I was like. He said, Brahma Wangso, the answer to the question why. There's nothing. And he looked at me and said, do you understand? I said, yes. And he said, no, you don't. And he walked off. I felt so deflated. But I always remember those encounters. A great moment. You know, he's given me sort of some teachings, straight from the heart, not from the books. They ask the question, why? Why are you suffering? Why are you here? What are you doing? Why are you happy? Why are you in pain? Why are you free of pain? Why? The answer? There's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. And that's the end of the talk today. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. But one day you will. Very good. I'm getting interviews now.